Lordy, lordy, we're back.
Dear Russell Lord, the terrible puns are starting early this episode.
Now, if you didn't hear part one, pause, go back. Or, I don't know, listen to another podcast in general. I don't know how you ended up here if you didn't listen to part one, but, you know, maybe be a maniac. Listen to part two. Don't listen to me. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just a voice inside your head right now.
Go crazy.
Yeah, you heard the man. Don't listen to him. Or do. And I mean, if you really want to go crazy, I mean, it's up to you. You press play on this. You might as well play all our content.
Yeah. So we covered our man, the Lord's early years, right? He talked about his schooling, his role in the Great War, his work as a journalist after, and linking up with Harry Truman. Nope. Wait. Tubman? Nope. Wallace. Why are there so many Harrys back then? No, it's Henry Wallace. Just, yeah.
You got it, buddy. Slowly losing that grip on reality, and I'm waiting to watch you fall.
Thanks. I'm so happy you're here for me.
Yeah, I'm down here in the abyss waiting.
So where we got to is basically when FDR got elected. Now, if you listen to the three episodes before part one, we talked about how this was kind of like this unique coalescing of opportunities. And it was kind of like this Hail Mary opportunity for permanent agriculture.
I mean, the ball's on you for thinking our audience knows what a Hail Mary is.
I was 17 years old, almost 18. I could almost vote when I found out it wasn't just a latch ditch play in football.
See, gotta have faith, Matt. So FDR's team eventually ended up recruiting Russell to serve as one of the journalists that was kind of like an unofficial mouthpiece for DC in this like permanent agriculture movement. His job was both to be a journalist that talked about what they were doing and also to be a ghostwriter to sell a lot of the New Deal's agricultural programs. He not only wrote pieces under his own name, but he also wrote speeches and articles on behalf of basically anyone that was advocating for permanent agriculture. He was just like pumping out content like all the time. It was also at this time that he wrote this really surprisingly successful piece for Vanity Fair. And in this piece, he highlighted this person who we don't have time to talk too much about, M.L. Wilson, who has these really interesting proposals around dry land farming and financial incentives for ethical agriculture, which at the time was, for some strange reason, one of the topics du jour, you could say, for like high society.
So what you're telling me is that in the past, rich people talked about farming instead of trying to keep up with celebrity relationships and rehabilitation? I mean, it sounds like Andy actually had a chance to hang in high society at one point. And it feels bad, man. It feels like you missed your shot.
I'm imagining like enlightenment coffee houses, but it's just Andy talking about fucking groundnuts. And Norm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in a three-piece suit with the stiff collar.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I think I'd be more like a philosopher, like half naked, hair down to my ass, like around a bunch of rich people, like almost like an oddity for them. Like, go speak to the Oracle.
Yeah, they keep calling him eccentric instead of batshit crazy.
Yeah. See? It could have been totally different. Totally different future. Now, what made Russell so unique was that he was able to take a lot of these complex social and scientific ideas, which we've started to talk on, but we're going to cover in a little bit more depth in a moment, and make them really accessible for folks that like had some basic education, but maybe didn't have much knowledge in science or agriculture. And it was because of this skill that he was really the face of part of this, or was a part of the movement, like what people envisioned, especially when we started talking about this idea of like agriculture being within a land ethic. So it was this skill in particular that like really made him important and driving FDR's vision, right? He could walk that line between populism and communism, something that like Roxford Tugwell, who we talked about, really struggled with, right? He started off like having this really great vision, not perfect by any means, but he had a vision. And then he kind of got red baited and basically lost any power in conversations because he was just this communist, right? And that was partly because like Tugwell had this like really academic interest in Russia, and even in like 1927 thought it was a good idea to travel there and see it, and, you know, gave a lot of ammo to the argument that FDR was a communist. And basically a lot of what Russell would do is take like Tugwell's ideas and take his radical position and make it a digestible argument for people to rationally agree with without it being particularly seen as communist.
Getting that Bernie Sanders treatment.
Yeah, it sounds like a classic case of it's not what you say, but how you say it.
Mm-hmm. And who's saying it?
When you're a dirty old communist. I can't do my Bernie accent. Sorry. I was trying to, for some reason, I like totally blanked on how he talks.
It's been so long.
It has. It's like, oh, the election's over. You don't hear his voice anymore.
It's like Queens, right? It's his accent.
It is. It's very Jewish Queens. Give me something to say. I can try. Okay, don't. We'll just move on. All right. So there was this big plan of Russell, you know, translating all these ideas, making them digestible, accessible, and that people are going to love them and perpetuate like these ideas, these talking points, revolutionize our food system. It did not go that way, obviously. We talked about kind of some of the bigger picture attempts of the FDR administration, but like, even though we spent three episodes talking about kind of how that 20 or 40 or so years played out up to FDR, we did very topical discussions about FDR's ag reform plans, because I mean, there's only so much you can cover, and Elliot was going to shoot me if I continued to talk about that in that episode. Now he's had a day or a month or so, and now we can talk about it again. So one of the first things in this in FDR's administration was to make sure the soil began to rest, right? Farmers began to see the effects of this, and they also were supported by the government, in theory, in this process. So basically, the government was like, let the soil rest, we're going to pay you to let it rest. However, what ended up happening is a lot of these direct payments went to the people who owned the land, not the people that were working the land. So basically, what happened for a lot of people was that money went directly to landlords, and they still wanted to collect from their tenants, their sharecroppers. And oftentimes, you know, those people also need to eat food, which didn't come from their landlords. So they had no work, and their landlords still wanted rent, and they were getting rich off of it. So, like, obviously, there were some issues in developing this. And Russell, along with many other people that were supportive of the New Deal, realized very quickly that plans were not going to go quite as proposed. This became a recurring theme.
Man, you fucking think? I mean, just like, it's the same thing. When you said that, I was thinking of the like COVID payments just a few years ago. Just like
the PPP ones?
Yeah, it's just the same.
Yeah, a bunch of rich businesses took them all, and everyone else that couldn't fill out 40 pages of applications got denied.
Yeah, but I feel like, you know, the concept was that it was supposed to trickle down, and I'm shocked that it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. Now, obviously, a lot of the farmers who were in support of these ideas were pretty demoralized after realizing that, like, it didn't get to them. And then, like that, like I said, that became a perpetuating thing. There was this national outrage to the 6 million suckling pig kill, the great cotton plowdown. And despite all of this, there's very little improvement in the daily lives of farmers.
I'm sorry, I can't let you just blaze over that. Did you say 6 million suckling pig kill?
Just mosey over that, right? Yeah, I was hoping you were going to pick on that.
I did.
You did. And it had a couple other really delicious names, you could say. It was also called the Porcine Slaughter of the Innocents. You might be familiar with that one.
Oh, yeah, of course. That name that's straight out of horror, anything, everywhere.
The Slaughter of the Innocents.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Okay. Imagine Slaughter of the Lambs, but it's Slaughter of the Pigs, and it's the same thing.
Hold on. Yeah. Slaughter of the Hams, you mean?
Slaughter of the Hams, okay. All right.
Silence of the Hams, I thought you guys were going for.
Oh, yeah, wait, that's what I'm... Wait, did I say Slaughter or Silence?
Yes, you did. But I thought you were just playing with the words. But all right, yeah. Either way, we got options here. We could have gone back in time and let them know about the silence of the Hams. Awful. Or Slaughter of the Hands.
There must have been a 4-year hiatus of the telling of the story of the Three Little Pigs that just made everybody cry.
R.I.P. in peace.
I'm sure it was probably around this day that the FDR administration learned about the importance of PR and spin.
Yeah, didn't go great. The American Farm Bureau Federation, which you might remember, was kind of that right wing owned by like a handful of very big farmers that were buying everything up in the late teens, early 20s, continued through the Great Depression, Dust Bowl, all that fun stuff. They tapped into this frustration and argued that FDR's policy changes were destroying America. In some cases, they had a valid point, but the reality is that a lot of states and other farm lobby groups began to see positive economic effects of letting the soil rest, reducing food production because we're just overproducing food. But the problem is that you had all these tenant farmers that were struggling, right? It didn't account for the fact that soil conservation was being done, but it wasn't being done at the scale it needed to be. In fact, one of the major failures of these policies was that landowners were receiving those checks, like I said, and the tenant farmers were leaving the farms because there was no work and there's no opportunity. It was so bad that Russell wrote this line. He said, "What had not been foreseen was the remarkable behavior of the bear." And when he was talking about the bear, he was referring not to the Netflix show, but the insatiable appetite of the landlords to continue just clawing any money they could get out of the system with no, like, blatant disregard for the ability of their tenants to survive and, like, quite literally survive. Like, you're talking about the 1930s when there was no support for you if you were in poverty, right? They were willing to let people literally starve on their farm while collecting checks and not even considering the effects of that. And yeah, people realize what the hell was happening.
I mean, bear, you say? It sounds like he picked that animal on purpose. It sounds awfully Soviet, if you ask me.
I see you pulling out the red paint.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you did have the clarification earlier, because this whole time, I did think we were talking about the HBO show, The Bear.
The fucking bear guy?
You're both wrong. It's Hulu. It's not Netflix or HBO.
You're right.
No, it's keeping us honest.
Yeah, I just finished watching The Bear, actually.
Somebody's going to fact check our asses one of these days.
Man.
No, we have never told a lie, ever. So we're good.
We should go at the end of our 10-year run with this podcast. We should offer one corrections episode.
Just one.
Just one.
There's only one correction, and it's Netflix over Hulu.
Yeah,
or Hulu over Netflix. That's the only corrections, 10-second episode. Mm-hmm. Anyways, as we're going to cover, and we started to cover in the last episode of that three-parter miniseries, is that there's a lot of different ideas about what permanent agriculture meant. And at this time, they were mostly kind of coalesced around this idea of, like, quite literally protecting the soil, growing food in the soil. That's what it meant. Thinking about how do we grow food without destroying the soil and keeping it healthy permanently. As we talked about with Liberty Hyde Bailey, he was very explicitly aware of the division between people that understood ecological, healthy, scalable systems versus the homesteader type, the what we'll talk about in a couple episodes, the back to the land advocates. And then Russell Lord, who is a student of Liberty Hyde Bailey through the school that he went through, well, both schools that he went through, he understood how to pair the values of the back-to-land advocates while not being so Luddite against technology, and then trying to pair that with this idea of, like, how do we take all the best of these things and move them forward? He was very good about trying to bring all these people kind of on the same page. So I want to go back to that article about M.L. Wilson that he wrote about in Vanity Fair. M.L. Wilson is a really interesting guy. We don't have much time to talk about him, but he did have a really important place in FDR's cabinet. And one of the things that FDR had Wilson do under the umbrella of the Division of Subsistence Homestead was this very bold idea of restoring small rural communities by advocating for factory work in rural communities that were supplemented by individual homesteads of a few acres. Now, our good friend Sexy Rexy was a very big advocate for this. Unsurprisingly, if you have been listening to us for a while, his plans were largely impractical. And of all the over 100 plans that were developed and put into place, only a few of these towns survived more than a few years. And a lot of this was driven by the interests of the new agrarians, which would later drive a lot of the back to the land that sprung up in the latter half of the 20th century, which we're going to be talking about later, and was really kind of a big part of the framework for what would become the homesteader movement today, something we'll talk about with like H.T. Odom and a number of other folks. Russell understood that they had good intentions, but he described them as ideal plans for ideal people rather than practical plans for real people.
Would you be able to speak like a little more to like what you said, like rural communities, but like factory work was what M.L. Wilson was proposing?
Yes. So what he was talking about was this idea of building towns that were basically, he wanted to develop self-sustaining communities that put out products that could, you know, cycle back into the economy. But the reality was that it didn't deal with the issue of homesteading, right? It was about you have to go work a full-time job or a almost full-time job, and then you have to go home and grow your own food all, like in your free time. Like, it wasn't addressing any of those issues of like why homesteading doesn't work, because you can't do a full-time job and then grow food inefficiently on such a small scale of a homestead and also work a full-time job. That's why every homesteader that's successful, it's because they make it their job, right? They monetize it somehow. It doesn't work otherwise. And no matter how many courses people will tell you that it does, it doesn't. And that was the problem. It was, well, people can just grow food in their part-time after they get out of work and yada, yada, yada. We're giving them the land. They can manage it. And as anyone listening to this knows, it's not that easy.
Right. I'm thinking of the like shitty vegetable gardens I grew when working full-time, and I'd really hate to live on that. And that's like half a carrot a month.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it doesn't work. You're too burnt out to be productive and good at doing it. Whereas the marginal gain from somebody that has a farm to add another dozen carrots is almost nothing. Whereas for you to just grow a dozen carrots in your backyard is suddenly like a half hour a week kind of job.
Right.
I mean, you don't have to sleep.
I mean, sometimes I feel that
way. Sleep is for the week. Just work full time and then grow your own food the rest of it.
The only time I sleep is when we run commercials. So,
you know, neighbors get uncomfortable when you're just digging in your backyard at night. I'll put that up there. Lantern light digging will scare people.
I think it was the dark PSA. Hooded robe.
Uh-huh. It was the shaded lantern, for sure. For sure.
Mm. It wasn't the giant hump in your back as you slowly moved forward in the backyard.
And it wasn't the rose bush that I had wrapped up I was trying to bury.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think it's time for a commercial.
When you fly, fly with us. Enjoy our panoramic windows, fresh fish, and nonstop flights to Ireland. United Bear Lines, where everywhere bears care, we fare with flair. Find out more at poorproles.com.
All right. For this commercial, I think you got to say something in the Bernie Sanders voice.
It's not what you do for your country. Yeah, I don't know.
I was going to say something about having bagels to schmear because I just love when New Yorkers say that.
Okay, so we're back. So Lord stayed kind of as this unofficial spokesman for FDR's programs, right?
Yeah, so he's basically a lobbyist.
For like tree crops and soil conservation, not like oil.
Man, just another stooge for big dirt.
Yeah.
I love that.
Now, he did this for a little while at least. As the programs were shuttered due to, in some cases, too much success.
Suffering from success!
Suffering from success!
Other cases from red baiting. In other cases, because soil takes time to restore and an overnight solution doesn't fix it. In some cases, just from projects, programs being poorly developed, as the ones we've just covered. As all this stuff was going on, Russell decided to move into this role of the chief information officer of the USDA under FDR. Now, in this role, he got to do what he loved to do, and that was travel the country and talk to farmers, specifically to find out the successes and failures of the government-sponsored projects. Unsurprisingly, in many cases, these destroyed lands weren't just suddenly restored. Some of the farmers argued that the reason why the programs didn't work was because the government didn't understand anything about agriculture.
Yeah, and I feel like we hear about this a lot on this podcast. Like, this is just giving me flashbacks to the Sunchokes episode.
You know, sometimes you're the sun, other times you're just choking.
It's beautiful, Matt.
Thanks. I think you made it in a meme.
I probably did. So the drought that had destroyed the Midwest in the 30s, you know, the Dust Bowl, so on.
Oh, that little thing?
That little thing. You might have heard of it. That continued. And despite the fact that policy changes went into place, so like there's only so much you can do to protect the soil when there's no rain or plants to keep it there, right? While FDR was president, there was all these huge spending packages. Henry Wallace, friend of our good buddy Russell Lord, was then moving into the 30s, the Secretary of Agriculture, and someday will probably be the subject of a future podcast episode because he's a really interesting guy.
Add it to the list.
It's on the list. Don't worry. Might be on the list twice. He understood that there was nothing the government could really do to restore these lands using like cover crops because, you know, you need water to get the cover crops to grow, and drought doesn't really allow for that, right? So that was not an option. It was just kind of a, let's try to do what we can where we can, and hopefully shit doesn't get too bad. Wallace, his argument was that we had to push states and regions to address their most serious problems as best they could and just be like, we're here for you guys.
I mean, states' rights are great when you're the federal government and don't have answers.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, cannabis laws. They suck everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Elliot's real mad that he moved out of a legal state.
No, that's not true. It's totally legal here. Nobody understands the law.
That's amazing.
I get weed delivered to my house in the mail, and it's fine.
Jesus Christ.
It's federally probably not legal, but in the state of Georgia, we're okay.
And this is what you were telling the sheriff's deputy when they came up.
This is on record. We'll give you the last four of his social. It's 3782. So,
oh my God, don't give him the real one.
That's just the one I'm using now. It's fine.
So in 1934, the drought it started to end. Rain came. In fact, too much rain came. And the topsoil that still existed was very quickly washed away. And this time of like increasing photography and so on meant that like gullies 50 feet deep were getting pictures sent to DC saying, hey, look at what's happening to the landscape. You thought the Dust Bowl was bad. Guess what? It got worse.
Welcome to the Flood Bowl.
Welcome to the Flood Bowl. And Lord spent a lot of his time writing appeals to Congress to release funds for these conservation efforts to figure out something to do. And Congress was like, nah, it's fine. We've given you enough money. Figure it out with the money we gave you. Why did we give you all that money? And this is where Russell really started using the tools at his disposal to get a lot of populist support for the conservation, for like getting some conservation done. Now, like I said, the Dust Bowl wasn't actually done. They just got this torrential downpour, and then like the Dust Bowl continued. And it was at this time that this dust storm rolled across the entire continent. It actually arrived in Washington, D.C. as the Senate debated funding on this bill about sending more money for conservation efforts. In the middle of the day in Washington, D.C., the sky became jet black as night. And for some strange reason, the Senate suddenly decided that they could move $25 million to deal with conservation issues and enacted what's called Public Act 46 on April 27th, 1935. Go check out the pictures from it because it's cool as hell.
And the lesson here is it'll take literal apocalypse conditions to get the government to do something about anything, and then they miraculously pull funds out their ass and send it on its way.
When it's too late.
Won't be enough.
Yeah, it's not applicable to today at all. We don't have any examples of that.
Nope.
Nothing to be worried about.
Yeah.
these conservation policies were not about restricting production as the previous ones had been about, but rather a more what you might consider like a scientific agrarian policy that was more focused on this idea of like addressing the regional attributes of the landscape, the needs for the community through community restoration, because you had all these farmers move out the last decade, right? Since the Dust Bowl began, farmers were leaving. FDR's policies made it even worse for farmers because they couldn't grow on the lands they were getting and their landlords still wanted money. So these communities just got decimated ecologically and human-wise, right?
Socially, Andy.
Socially, yes. That is the word that supposedly people use. And this became a way for Russell to really merge or blend his understanding of what ecology meant for him.
Agriculture with ecology? Who would have thunk it?
Right? What? Why would plants be related to the management of plants?
That's what we're talking about. That's what we're always talking about.
That is what we're always talking about.
Always talking about.
It's like the basis of this podcast.
It's almost like why the first part of this episode, I was like, Russell Lord reminds me of this podcast. It's because he was kind of doing the same thing 80 years ago before us. So after a decade of advocating for this idea of like a new land ethic, traveling across the United States multiple times, going to Europe during World War I, standing alongside the biggest names in agriculture and knowing basically anyone important in politics, Russell took that as a moment to say, you know what? Fuck all y'all. I'm out. And he left Washington and purchased an abandoned farm in Hartford County, Maryland. The farmhouse that he bought had 20 acres of overgrown briar-filled fields. And he found a lot of farmers in this area working to restore and protect the valley. Many of the families who had been there since the 1700s, and they were using a lot of conservation practices like terracing, contour plowing, and a lot of the things folks listening to this are probably familiar enough with. This valley is a pretty unique place. Many of the most fertile lands in the area had been taken by the government during World War I to build mustard gas factories and munitions test ranges. Because, you know, that's the best use for all of your good farmlands, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously. Now, between this and the farm abandonments that were happening between the late 19th century, mid-late 19th century to basically the time we're talking, a lot of the farmers that remained at this point had really learned to work cooperatively to defend the community because they were like kind of the last men standing here, right? Because of this, the Hartford County Soil Conservation District was one of the first in the country to form under the Soil Conservation Service, and its successes were basically used as models for future rural lands preservation.
And this was before Lord joined them?
Correct.
The Lord?
Correct.
So they prayed and he answered? Or actually, they did something about it and then he just came in.
Showed up. Yeah, showed up and took the credit.
He just showed up late and took the credit.
So while on his new farm, and what's interesting is that he never really likes to call his farm a farm. He calls it a word farm because he's like very aware of the fact that like homesteading is not farming. And he doesn't even really want to quantify and put himself in that category. Because he was this name of recognition among farmers, he would get these letters all the time from farmers across the country about their improved yields, the results from the practices that he'd been advocating for decades, stories from people. Because of this, he started thinking about the farmers around him, those in the Deer Creek Valley, and he pushed them to start writing about their own successes. And it got to the point where he was getting like a canvas bag of letters a day through the mail from all these farmers, and they wouldn't just talk about successes. They would write poems, newsletter clippings that they were like, oh, Russell needs to see this. And Russell called the information that was kind of all funneled to him from across the country, in his words, more pertinent information as to what's actually going on at the grassroots and in the minds of people farming than what could be gathered in any book, end quote.
And that's valid because, like, those stories aren't just valuable as field evidence, but they're, like, a reflection of the farmers being able to, like, share experiences in a way that connects with other farmers.
Yeah, and I think, like, storytelling is important and, like, obviously science is as well, but, like, the idea of, like, getting science out of the hands of just specialists and sharing that space with the people actually doing the work validates it in a much different way.
Yeah, it sounds like all their work is peer-reviewed.
Poor proles reviewed?
No. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and during this time, again, permanent agriculture kind of exists as like this catch-all, right? But this homesteading ideology that's been pushed by like Tugwell and others kind of fallen to the side as people, like every time homesteading becomes a big thing, realize it doesn't work and kind of lose interest. The fact that it started kind of falling to the side allowed, or to the periphery, allowed a new focus to be placed on like these displaced rural poor farmers that were able to be addressed through the Resettlement Administration, which was established in 1935. Now, this program worked to transplant farmers, especially those in drought-prone areas. Farmers were given resources to develop conservation farming, as well as a number of other things. Now, Russell was the primary contributor for all of these resources. One of the things that he advocated very explicitly for was that farmers learn the ecological constraints of their land.
Okay, so can you break down for us exactly what conservation farming is?
So he advocated more explicitly for helping landscapes by understanding that landscapes adapted specifically to their regional climates, the regional soil type, the way rainfall fell on the landscape. And it was important to understand that these structures, the bedrock of the ecosystem, were left in place. And he pointed to those successes that he'd seen in France back during World War I. And this idea that like this longer history of humanity of living in alignment with local ecosystems, that we've done it for thousands of years, we don't have to recreate the wheel. It has existed before. And on his own farm, he decided he would put those theories to test.
And this is where we insert the foreshadowy musical tones.
Is this good foreshadowing or bad foreshadowing?
Don't know. Throughout this time, soils across the country had continued to deteriorate because, as we said, the rain didn't come, and then it came, and then it stopped coming, but not on a scale that made sense, right? So as the government policies were put in place on larger scales, they didn't really address these nuances of the landscape. As these farms began to fall apart, as we pointed to, the fact that these rural communities were falling apart, it accelerated. The full society of rural communities just absolutely collapsed. And by 1938, Russell resigned from his position as the chief information officer at the USDA and decided that he would freelance.
Wait, I thought you said he already left.
He left Washington.
To go to Deer Valley. Oh, okay.
But, and so he did leave Washington. But, you know, you can leave Washington, but it doesn't necessarily leave you.
Yeah, I guess that's true. The jobs in Washington are like national jobs, so you cannot be there and still do it. But then when you quit your job, then you leave Washington.
Guys, hold on. I have breaking news. I'm sorry this is coming out like 6 months late, but as we were recording this, you want to see what just fucking happened?
What's up?
Are you ready? Can you read that?
Henry Kissinger dead at 100.
Fuck yeah. Sorry, we're very emotional right now. Oh my god. I feel the world is brighter today.
Wait. Hang on.
These fuckers living to 100.
Is that it?
Because God won't smite them, Elliot. Come on, Lord.
He's afraid of them.
Oh my god. So that is just beautiful.
Wow,
what a
historic moment.
When people ask where I was, I'll be able to say I was in the middle of talking about the Lord.
Yeah, and you just did a shot.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, it's really appropriate. The last thing I just said was that you can leave Washington, but it doesn't leave you, and then fucking Kissinger dies. Like, come on.
Wow.
You don't get many of those moments in life. I'm just saying.
You do not. That was well timed. Kissinger dead.
Take it in. Just take it in. All right. So
back to the Lord's work.
Part of the reason why he wanted to leave the government is because he could fully articulate his concerns and his vision of what sustainable agriculture looked like to him, or a land ethic looked like to him. He wasn't tied down by the needs of trying to sell what the government needed to sell. Basically, that the work being done that he was seeing was just this very small step in what we needed to do. He believed that the government was too far removed to address both the ecological and the social problems, and that centralized regulatory power threatened the health of rural society, and particularly its ability to have a democracy, which, you know, given the state of rural communities in the South, I think he might have been on to something. Now, he did feel that the South was where it would be most obvious, where poor farmers were tasked with this idea of, like, totally reshaping the landscape because it had been decimated by agriculture, and they had no resources to do that. You know, oftentimes the government would show up and give plans, and without the resources or full understanding of the resources for the farmers or the full understanding by the government of the specific local conditions, the plans would actually make the landscape worse. And it wasn't because the plans were bad. They just didn't address this nuance and they didn't provide the resources to make it successful. While this was happening, you also saw these southern landlords that were rich and they benefited incredibly from the New Deal payouts. And the idea of, like, changing that and giving the landless, predominantly black farmers, any bit of self-determination was like the worst thing. So even though they were benefiting from these programs, they were still pushing to get rid of them because they were afraid if they stuck around long enough, they might get fixed.
Damn.
It's fucked up, right?
I mean, I guess getting paid to instill change and then make sure nothing changes so that you everything stays the same.
sounds pretty America.
It sounds like America. It does. Mm-hmm. I like it. Where do
Federal
I sign up?
Program with no nuance? For 2 days?
So at this point, he'd only seen proof of concept and the real work was basically just beginning, right? He saw that the fact that, like, the government was just failing at addressing these issues at any local level, right? And that the idea of, like, rural community health was being absolutely pushed aside in the name of soil restoration, which was regardless being done poorly. So it wasn't like you were getting a positive out of it. Now, at the same time in 1937, Henry Wallace, his good friend, had been named FDR's running mate and departed from his position as the Secretary of Agriculture. And Russell joined him on this trip that was called the Tobacco Road Tour as a journalist. And basically, they went through poor rural southern communities where farmers were still struggling, despite all of these really great New Deal assistance programs. Womp womp. Now, Wallace knew of the struggles in the South, but, like, going there and seeing it is obviously a different thing. And oftentimes, Wallace would abandon his tour stops to walk fields and talk with sharecroppers, most of whom, given that there was no internet or anything, had no idea that they were talking to the potential vice president of the country. And he would ask, like, what they needed to be successful. What became obvious to both of them was that the idea of poor land health and human poverty were closely linked, and you couldn't really address one without the other. This led to the what's called the Bankhead-Jones Farm Tenancy Act, and the Resettlement Administration was structured as the Farm Security Administration, which even to this day remains the strongest rural poverty relief and aid agency in the USDA today.
I mean, so we're talking about a guy who was Secretary of Agriculture, right? And then he ran as vice president, and he was walking around talking to random farmers and the Deep South.
Yeah, basically. And you never actually let me finish my story about him and George Washington Carver, who was friends with his dad.
Don't make me like that famous white man.
What? You know what? Commercial.
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
I thought he was black this whole time.
Henry Wallace or George Washington Carver?
George Washington Carver.
He was black, but he was friends with Henry Wallace's dad back in, like, the mid-19th century before that was okay. So yeah, it's kind of interesting story. He like grew up with George Washington Carver as like his dad's buddy. It's like wild, like weird intermingling of history.
Reminds me of Dave Chappelle from Undercover Brother, where he claims George Washington Carver made the first computer out of a peanut.
I don't remember that one.
Oh, it's so good.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
I know, we were just talking about him just like talking to random ass farmers. Can you imagine you're like working a hard day in the field and this guy just comes like trotting across the field wanting to talk to you about like federal...
How shitty your job is.
Yeah, and just
Just imagine how he was dressed.
Yeah.
Like just completely out of place in like in a field.
Yeah, you're trying to like move this
like fucking Mr. Bean.
Fucking like field stone and some guy's like, dude, no.
What do you need to make your job and life better? He's like, money?
Yeah.
Everything?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this fucking field? It sucks.
Hot as hell out here. Do something about this sun, this heat.
So anyways, Russell continued to write. He released his fifth book in 1939 called The Agrarian Revival, which was focused on tying a century of topsoil loss to the evolution of agricultural education. And that is an interesting topic, but we're not going to dive into that right now. Instead of diving through library archives, our good friend Russell decided that he should tour the country again because he had not seen enough of it.
This guy loves touring the country. I'm going to say it. This guy loves touring the country.
Loves a good train. And his idea was to speak with all the folks that had been with the extension programs across the country in the 20s.
All right, so they're going out to learn some more things.
Basically, no one in the country knew rural poor communities the way Russell Lord did. The man knew a rural community. While he did believe that the government had provided some improvements, it became very clear to him that top-down solutions was fundamentally at odds with the nuance of soil, and his belief that only when farmers then themselves gain the ability to determine and define their own changes and methods, that those changes could actually happen. So to him, this idea of like a permanent agriculture was dependent on having a system culturally, socioeconomically, that could change alongside it with the same nuance and understanding and self-determination that the farmers would have with their soil. And what that meant to him was that the only thing that was really permanent in permanent agriculture was change.
Man, it's almost like ecology and self-determination go hand in hand. Imagine that.
Right, and it sounds like those mass exodus from the farms to the cities to work factory jobs really did much more lasting damage, because it's hard to get people out of the cities back to the farms when they don't have that connection to the ecology, to the land, and know how to work it.
And no generational knowledge.
Right. No. Right.
Immediately after returning home, once again from his lovely train tour, Lord went back on the road again with the Soil Conservation Service to speak with the folks on the ground working with farmers. Say it, Matt.
The man loved a good farmer, Chad. He really did. He was all about it.
Yeah, he did. The man loved to talk to farmers. One of the interesting things that he saw during this trip was that people would work across property lines voluntarily to design landscape-scale conservation plans that benefited all community members instead of working with the government, which wanted them to do the same thing, which is like, huh, that's interesting. And when he spoke to these farmers who were doing this, they talked about how in the past, when farmers needed things, that they were ignored in the name of the war efforts. So they're just kind of like, you guys fucked us, fuck you, which I get it. At the same time, during this particular trip, he visited the Navajo, and he spoke with ecologists about how only when, in quote, improved breeds, end quote, and technology arrived, that the unique brittle dune grassland environment that had sustained the Navajo communities for hundreds of years suddenly got destroyed.
Sounds like they let that fucker Alan Savory in the Southwest too.
Man, all my homies hate improved breeds.
All my homies do. Well, not all improved breeds. Locally adapted improved breeds. We like those.
Fuck, Andy, don't bring nuance into this.
No,
sweeping
we
conclusions
don't do...
only.
Okay.
I understand some of those words.
So, unsurprisingly, there was lots of stories that followed the same trajectory for him. The canyons known today as the Providence Canyon started in the 1700s, and in the course of a few short centuries, due to a combination of deforestation, monocropping, poor farming methods, all that good stuff, They washed away basically all of the topsoil.
I gotta look this up.
I believe you mispronounced American excellence and abundance.
Yes. Number one being number one. Providence, winning.
Canyons.
Back-to-back World War champs.
At this time, one war champs.
They had a title to defend.
Yeah.
We haven't won a war since 1996.
Did we win a war in 1996?
No.
Okay. All right. So Russell did what he could do, and that was he wrote. In his recent books at this time, he wrote about basically how soil worked to a layman and how it was lost. He discussed the future of soil, about the failures of the agrarian icon Thomas Jefferson, who, oh boy, we could do some content on, and the long ongoing battles that would have to exist to save our soils, to save our forests, to save our waterways.
It's on the list.
You want to put Thomas Jefferson on the list? The only way we could make that interesting is if I found out he was my great, 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 great grandfather.
I mean, I just want to shit all over him. So, you know, that could be fun. But in Lord's book, To Hold the Soil, that he released in 1938, he explains how World War I had accelerated mass destruction of soils. The book was to basically make everyone who cared about a healthy environment find their place in the new efforts. Not everyone had to do everything, but everyone had to do something. This collection of essays is basically considered to be like a manifesto that kind of framed his whole idea for the idea of like a new society that existed outside of both government and corporate ties. Hint, hint. A number of folks agreed with him about this. Merrill Cook, who was really important with the TVA and the electrification of rural Tennessee. Hugh Bennett, who had been the head of the Soil Conservation Service. And then our good, good buddy, Russell Lord, started talking about this idea of an organization that existed like this, right? And it was based on Liberty Hyde Bailey's plan for a society of the holy earth, which he described in his book, Universal Service. Liberty Hyde Bailey's a really interesting guy. Go check out our episodes on him. Soon after that, a meeting was set to talk about an idea, to figure that out.
Wow, I hate and love the fact that I fully understood how we've talked about all these people in separate episodes, and now it's all coming together.
It's almost like I planned it.
Yeah, Andy, your head's getting huge because basically all of these episodes are just one conversation that you've had in your own head.
Yes.
Oh my God. I do not want to, well, I guess, yeah, it's just these episodes. I was going to say I don't want to see what's in that, but it's just documented in hours and hours of podcasts.
Content. So Russell's books were successful, and as always, he traveled the country, wrote another book.
This guy.
Called Forest Outings. And now Forest Outings is really interesting as a book because it honestly might be the first written book by a white dude that talks about place-based knowledge and like really starts pointing at this idea of like tech, of traditional ecological knowledge. He goes to Puerto Rico and visits the subsistence farmers in the rainforests. He defends the work of indigenous people of living within the demands of that unique landscape. Again, this is before the idea of tech had ever became cool in academia. He went to the desert forests of New Mexico and Northwest Florida, and basically he became really interested in like how people were living, including like the Creek Seminole, who lived illegally in the national forests in Northwest Florida, and they lived this isolated subsistence farming and fishing camp lifestyle in the forest.
What year was this?
1940.
I love how you said that, like, they lived there illegally, but really
no,
they
literally did.
No, they just lived there. It's like they just lived there.
They've been there, yeah.
Yeah.
Plymouth Rock landed on us kind of shit.
Yeah, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
Exactly. And like, so the Creek Seminole is really interesting because they were often blamed for dry season fires. And during Lord's visit, he saw the intentional fires that they lit to clear tinder from the understory and how they collected the char for their gardens, much like we had talked about, like the Maya. The farmers' grounds and the camps around the Creek Seminole were safe from fires because of their management. And the forest farmers there utilized the char along with wetland mulch and mineral sands to build soil that would be inherited by the next generation to grow food just as good, if not better, than those grown by the best farmers in the nation. So it became very clear at this point in the 1940s to Russell that like prescribed burns were very important and that indigenous people had this knowledge that conventional agriculture hadn't even touched yet.
Okay, so it took up until this point where Russell Lord had mentioned, he had mentioned ecological knowledge about the land would help improve the land and prevent the predicament that the U.S. was currently in at the time. But I think this is the first time we've actually talked about those indigenous land management in practice, where he's like seen it work and understands that this is the way to go.
Yeah, basically at this point, again, nobody had really talked about this idea of indigenous knowledge or tech or like what that really looked like. It was permanent agriculture, but it wasn't about like, it wasn't contextualized within a history. And it was because of that nuance in the landscape that that history became so important in order to understand how people had done it in the past.
Man, it's really wild, like how relatively unknown he is, but like so ahead of his time.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. That's why I wanted to do this two-parter. After this tour for this book, he decided to return home, sold his farm called, or whatever, Writer Farm, whatever you want to call it, and instead thought about this idea of like building this permanent agriculture movement that he envisioned. And the idea was what he called a national organization of non-technical people working voluntarily outside government to interest more and more city people in the conservation of our indispensable soil.
I mean, hell of a tagline.
On January 23rd, 1940, they gathered for the first time, along with a number of major other figures in conservation. It was here that the name the Society of the Friends of the Land was coined. Now, what made their organization different was that agricultural and ecological education should be free and shared for the public to build broad support of the protection of nature and agricultural lands. Further, this was framed within a context focused on democracy, egalitarianism, and most importantly, an understanding that everyone had a duty to understand and work with the land when possible. Fundamentally, the organization was based on the concept of interdependence that had underscored all of Russell's work. The organization was focused on this idea of developing a membership of both scientific and citizen members.
Yeah, he really put a dagger in it when you couldn't get people to do this for full-time work, because at the time, people really needed jobs. And if it's volunteer-based, he's just making the poor Lord's Almanac.
The Lord Prole's Almanac.
The Friends of the Lord's Almanac would probably sell then.
The Lord of the Prole's Almanac.
You guys done?
Yeah.
Okay. The first gathering of this organization was on March of 1940. As the speakers focused on a future framed in an ecology, Russell saw future contributors to an unfunded and unpublished journal that he had tentatively titled The Land Quarterly. Unfortunately, the event was kind of a sober reminder of how forward-thinking the group was. Reviews were mixed, suggesting that their concerns were too far away, because he did talk about stuff like climate change with the 1940s. Yeah, it seemed pretty far away. And that the project appeals rather to, in quote, the kind of man who plants an oak tree or endows an orphan's home, according to reporter Gerald W. Johnson.
Right, criticizing planting oak trees now?
Yeah, bold, but not wrong.
Now, the manifesto read that, in quote, we too are all of one body. We all live on or from the soil. End quote. And a lot of the criticisms were that they were too philosophical, not framed in a world on the brink of World War II, that they were just kind of hippy-dippy before hippie was a thing, right? And the following month, unfortunately, Germany invaded Norway.
Also a pretty unhippy-dippy thing to do.
Also an unhippy-dippy thing to do. It took nearly a year before the organization actually raised enough money for its first journal. And during this time, Lord worked basically around the clock preparing materials and realized that the organization needed like a celebrity. And he found Lewis Bromfield, who was a pretty famous author who also managed Malabar Farm, which also was kind of an experimental farm that toyed with this idea of permanent agriculture for ecosystem rehabilitation.
I love that those like celebrity farmer authors take me back.
Yeah, I'm still good. I don't ever want to go back in time.
Matt wants to make America great again. You heard it here first.
You did hear it here first.
So quickly, the magazine grew. The quality improved as folks like Bromfield, Paul Sears, Vice President Wallace, E.B. White, beside those major names, Hugh Bennett, there were poems from regular farmers, many with like no actual formal education. There would be debates that would erupt in the columns of the magazine. Agronomists with PhDs would debate with farm wives. It basically was like kind of Facebook before Facebook, except like a very niche part of it, right? Facebook groups for like hedge laying or some shit. Those exist, trust me.
And we all know the beef that goes on in those.
There is beef, all right? Now, it basically became this kind of open space for views that were around this very niche topic, right? And like a lot of folks wrote in this before they became famous, which is really interesting. So like Lord had like a really good eye for like identifying people that knew what they were talking about. So like one of them was like Edward Faulkner, who would later become, would write the book called Plowman's Folly. And this was like the first international book that really advocated for like the disc plow, which cuts up and incorporates organic matter into the soil instead of burying it deep into the soil.
Trash farm guy.
What? What are we, who?
Isn't that what he called the book? Trash farming?
And they say white people don't have culture. We have trash farming. So let's just take a moment and just appreciate that he created like the first Facebook fighting. So the magazine began to expand its content, include problems and realities of the war technologies that were being created and the development of agricultural industrialism, right? While some of the stuff like war technologies might seem out of place, to Russell is a reminder of the like interconnectedness of how permanent agriculture and the quality of life for all things on the planet were intrinsically tied, right? This was a strong push against the idea of how environmentalism was understood, that conservation was this separation of humanity as opposed to our integration into it, right? They were asking questions, like I said before, about climate change and whether or not industrialization could be sustained in a long-term picture. So like it was pretty radical stuff that was coming out of these magazines for like just a fucking nerdy agricultural collection. There's one article, I was just reading it a couple days ago because I have this collection from The Land, and it was J. Russell Smith talking about contraception. So like it was just like wildly ahead of its time for what it was. But with this radically progressive position come a lot of risks, right? Not everyone that's reading it's going to support it. It did allow for a lot of claims of people that contributed to it to be communists or, you know, some kind of socialist, right? And, you know, you have to also consider it within the context. It came out during the war, and from the war to 1945, over 1.5 million people had abandoned the farming profession. And by 1950, that number had escalated to 2 million.
Man, a lot of, just like over and over again, huge losses of people working the land.
Yeah, a lot of losses.
Right. And that's fascinating, too, because there are stories of all the factory workers who had to basically do their own subsistence farming and like windowsill gardens to help grow food because the food was rationed at the time.
For the war efforts. Yeah. Right. Now, in 1951, The Land had reached over 7,000 subscribers. However, it quickly faltered as Russell, now getting pretty up there in his age, couldn't really keep up with the demands of the role. It put quite a big bullseye on himself and people that he worked with. He was introducing a lot of new authors, like I said, who would go on to leave a mark in history. One of the big, big ones is Rachel Carson, who many people are familiar with because of her work around DDT. But often he ended up, as he got older, just recycling content from other magazines and things he'd collected from years before. And at this time, as he started kind of losing his ability to keep up, the magazine got painted as for a specific type of farmer, like a rich farmer. And that obviously wasn't great. So by 1954, the magazine had dropped to below 1,500 subscriptions, and in 1954, it was quietly ended. And I do want to talk about this more in a minute.
Man, I'm pretty sure the perennial crop farmer to esoteric old man vagrant yelling at clouds for rich people is a real pipeline. A small one. Small copper pipeline, but it's there and very real.
It's a very nice copper pipeline, and I feel like you're judging me.
A little
and
bit.
You should feel like that.
Good. It should be no surprise that advocates for interdependence were painted as anti-American, communists, and yada, yada, yada. And as that anti-communism rose in the 1950s and 60s, guess what? They became targeted. Now, at the same time, we kind of talked about this in previous episodes. The early seeds of that green revolution had been planted, and like the idea of like genetics, pest management, and soil chemistry were framed as this like, oh, this is how we solve our farming problems. We don't need to do anything else. We just let the scientists figure it out. So advocates of this idea of permanent agriculture quickly became targets as anti-communism rose across the country. So for folks like Rexford Tugwell to Vice President Henry Wallace, anyone that kind of supported this idea became a very easy target. It got to the point where any members of collectivist organizations, like, for example, the Friends of the Land, were under the watch of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. Russell didn't take this sitting down. He fired back, calling the McCarthyists defenders of, in quote, entrenched bureaucracy.
I mean, are you even doing cool work if J. Edgar isn't listening to your phone calls?
Imagine, you know, this guy just loves acorns and, like, dirt, and you have the president. He's like, tap his fucking phones.
No till. I mean, no time till I bug your house.
Oof. Now, despite Russell's attempts to kind of quell the political division ripping across the country and its his own readers apart, its contributors became even more outspoken against, like, America's political climate and the global events that were escalating towards the Cold War, right? During the same period, corporations were beginning to collaborate more heavily with the government under the guise of the Green Revolutions in Africa, Central America, and India, which we've covered to an extent in other episodes. Go check them out. They're really interesting. This idea of, like, promising to solve food insecurity in second world countries as a tool to block communism from expanding, right? And that's something we still do to an extent. Like, that's why we produce so much food and send it overseas, is because then we get to run their governments and then they have no reason to invest in their own agricultural systems. But that's for another time. So basically what was happening is that corporations provided the resources and technologies as the government funded research on behalf of the corporations across the globe. The USDA quickly became an adversary to the permanent agriculture movement because there's no money in growing fucking trees. As selling the idea of the Green Revolution was both anti-communist action and fed the needed growth of our commodities markets and expanded the base for growing crops under the American dollar.
I feel like every time we talk about this stuff and the Green Revolution comes up, I get mad for a whole new reason. And it just feels like it was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it was, in a lot of ways. Now, despite all of the pressures, Russell never backed down from his belief. And in 1953, 2 years before closing the magazine, he included an essay from a scientist criticizing the use of synthetic chlorinated hydrocarbons, aka DDT, DDE, and so on, among others, which had been described as safe by their producers, and said, they're lying. Despite the onslaught of attacks, the article pointed to the profound changes happening in people's backyards. Now, the author, Rod Kokin, in his essay, described the work he did studying the effects of chemical drift with DDT as much as he could without breaking classified protocol. This release was the first public criticism of these new synthetic compounds and, despite only reaching a few thousand readers, would spur others to become more wary of these chemicals and that had otherwise been accepted as improvements across the agricultural spectrum. The line in the sand had kind of been drawn between the permanent agriculture movement and the corporatist movement in the United States, and it became very clear that the future of American agriculture and what we needed would continue to indefinitely be different.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it sounds like one made more money than the other.
And they said, fuck people, we're going to do the money one. So like I said,
the Corporal's Almanac. Fuck people, yes. We're going to do the money one.
Yeah, that's our bumper sticker, everyone.
That's the bumper sticker for the episode.
Yeah. So as time rolled forward, 1954, Lord was frustrated with the state of politics in the United States, and he published the final chapter of Lewis Bromfield's latest book, A New Pattern for a Tired World. He ended it with a simple quote, and I think this is really great. He says, "The truth is that we have wandered a long way from reason and reality during the past generation. Our destinies have been largely controlled by men with curiously distorted and misshapen personalities, from Hitler to Stalin to communist leaders and traitors everywhere, to the figures in our own immediate history whose balance and wisdom have been dubious. It is time for the simple people to revolt."
I mean, he wasn't wrong.
No, he wasn't, but we were too poor. That's the whole point. If you don't have any money, how are you going to revolt?
Well, they're poor, they're proles, and they had his almanac. So, I mean, they were basically there. Come on. Elliot did not like that joke. So
we need a professional militia. Mm-hmm. We're going to do the money one.
clearly he came to this idea of adaptiveness is the need, and that his future vision wasn't something that he would ever see in his lifetime, but he still believed in it. In the last few years of his life, he focused a lot on his concerns a lot on this idea of like the suburbanization of America, because you have to remember the idea of suburbs didn't exist until highways, which didn't exist until World War II. And then, you know, the development of like suburbia over the 50s and 60s. And it became this like new horrific way that the ecology was being destroyed outside of the other ways that we'd been doing it. Now, as we're going to talk, during the 1960s and 70s, a new generation moved back to the land, was part of this like new homesteader thing. And Lord said that, in quote, "No one of country rearing can be wholly unsympathetic regarding this back to the earth stampede of transients and new residents in rural parts, but that they would simply live out in the country and not be at home there," end quote. The people that were returning to the land were often not doing so out of necessity and frequently came from like money, basically, and generally had like security. So it wasn't about like needing to grow food to survive. It was about like what we see today with like a lot of homesteaders, like wanting to disconnect from the land and doing really expensive ways of growing food because you don't trust society or some bullshit like that, right? Basically, the conditions that led to this movement were less about the need and more about the failures of like the modern capitalist condition to provide like a meaningful life in society and feeling connected to the landscape and the world around you. And this is something we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks.
Of course we are.
Yeah, no stone unturned on this podcast, painstakingly.
Mm-hmm. Painstakingly. Now, only 2 years after the release of his final book, The Care of the Earth, Russell died. His work had always been about finding this balance between like holistic management of the land and like utilizing the tools and the machinery that humans had developed to create a permanent agriculture. And trying to find like this intersection of agriculture, ecology, and humanity, right? And that is something I think we see come up a few decades later with, you know, Murray Bookchin, and primarily. He's the one that kind of takes this torch, although I don't think he's actually familiar with any of his work. That's, I think, when people talk about like this idea of like society's health is tied to like ecological health, people talk about Murray Bookchin, but like Russell Lord was talking about it 50 years before. The reason why I wanted to do this episode is because like his name is hard to find, and like he was really historically important and visionary. He doesn't even have like a Wikipedia article. You can find some of his books on Amazon fairly cheap, and he doesn't really have any of that cultural relevance of any of the people that he was surrounded by.
He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, people.
He doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. His image doesn't even exist on the internet. It might like in some archives someplace, but he's lived it. My point is that like his work needs to live on. We have to think about how he contributed to like the development of permanent agriculture and where we stand today and how we kind of envision agriculture moving forward and what our job is like as the writers, the advocates on our side of things, and trying to bridge all these gaps and push forward a better vision.
Yeah, we've immortalized him in these past few episodes, so he lives on, and his ideas will live on. And I hope they inspire our listeners as much as they inspired me. I'm going to definitely use his name, and
putting on some Molotov cocktails.
Yeah, Russell Lord coming at you.
The Lord's mix.
That's right.
So if you did enjoy this, I know it might be hard to believe, there is more information about him in our Substack article. It's quite lengthy, lots of sources.
Andy dug deep on this one.
I only dig deep, man.
I think it came from admiration. You really like the guy.
I went down a rabbit hole with him, and he's a real interesting dude. And if you tell me somebody was a big deal and there's no information about him on the internet, now I'm going to find it.
Yeah.
That's what happened with our buddy, fuck is his name? That's what happened with Ephraim Hernandez, is that his name was like, I could find like three sentences about him. Like, there's got to be more. And then, you know, 3 months later, we had that series of episodes. But yeah, this is fun. Super interesting guy. Buy all of his books. You can actually get a collection of the most important essays or most popular essays from the land, and I think it's called In the Land. The author's last name is Pittman. I can't remember the first name, but if you look up The Land Pittman on Amazon, you can probably find a copy of it. Basically, everyone that we've talked about in this series has an article in there, which is pretty cool. And yeah, go check it out. I think next week we have interviews, actually, which I'm real excited about because we haven't done one of those in a while. But then we're going to be going into the Back to the Land, HD Odom, all that cool stuff. So I'm real excited. I know Matt's high and confused. And Elliot
that
is
also
same.
And Elliot is same. If you want to support this work, you want to check out the new content early, go on Patreon, do that thing. And yeah, did you guys have fun?
Yeah, it was a good episode. Yeah. Russell Lord's the doing the Lord's work.
Doing the Lord's work.
Praising the Lord.
Praise the Lord, everyone.
He was ahead of his time. Nobody listened, and when they disagree with, if you disagree with anybody, just call him a communist.
That is the lesson here, is call everyone a communist and you get your way. Questions?
All right, well, I'll see you communists later. Thanks for listening.